the OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. OTB AM.
With Gillette, we don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters.
So it's part three of our discussion with Bernard Brogan about his new book, which is called The Hill. And I'm delighted to say, to get straight into it, we have his brother Alan on the line. Alan, how are you?
Hey, Jared.
How's it going?
I'm good, yourself?
You come out pretty well from the book. That's the first thing that we have to say here.
That'd be nice.
That was a prerequisite. And to be fair to Bernard, I think he just put the rose tinted glasses on sometimes when he's talking about me.
I want to finish at the end, or I want to start rather at the end, and your last point kicked for Dublin. We've already had Mark O'Shea on talking about the Dublin-Kerry rivalry. If you were to script an end to a Dublin career, kicking the last score against Kerry in an All-Ireland final into the Hill, that's not bad.
Yeah, look, I suppose it was perfect. And when I came back at the start of 2015, obviously losing to Donegal in 2014, I could have maybe, when I was on the way out here, and I said, look, we give it one more go, and the finish like that was pretty special. And like, I know not everyone gets to finish in those terms, kind of on their own terms, if you want to call it that, but I knew when I kicked that score that was right time to get off the stage here now.
You got the assist as well.
Yeah, I could have taken a leaf out of his book and retired a few years ago, but I know. It was a nice way to end. I'd say Alan probably was frustrated that year, didn't get as much game time as you would have liked throughout the year, but It's all forgotten about when you get a score like that. So it was a nice tribute. Yeah,
I was looking at it again just to remind myself of it this morning. It was absolutely sensational score. Like, in fairness, your assist is like a hand pass, still in your own half just about, and it's a long dribble in wild conditions, straight into the hill and swarming Kerry defence, and it's a little swivel of the hips, and all of a sudden the space opens up and kicks a beautiful score.
Yeah, I think Dermo made a hard run looking for the ball inside him. And brought the two defenders, and Alan's probably going to give it. And then he said, "Do you know what? I might have a go at this." So it just opened up, and yeah, like he's done before, just slotted over into the hill. Lovely, lovely, lovely end.
Can we go back then to the not so nice memories against Kerry? We've talked a little bit earlier on about the start of Learwig's game, Alan. The aftermath of that and what happens with Pat Gilroy is one of the most fascinating sections of the book, and I'm really interested in your perspective on it, because obviously we've got Bernard's in the book where there are training sessions where Pat Gilroy is giving it to him at a level that, you know, I'm not sure many people would take or be able for, and you're in the car going, "Don't worry, it's not personal." What's your recollection of that period of time?
Yeah, I think Pat challenged everybody maybe four or five in front. And after 2009, whenever Meade got the five goals on us as well, I think that was 2010 maybe. But so, like, it wasn't all rosy in the garden at the start of kind of Pat's reign either. And it kind of took him a year or a year and a half to get to grips with it as well and really start to implement the changes that he was trying to implement. And but he had a way about him, Pat. Like, he's I think Bernard talks about in the book, like, he has a kind of a sarcastic wit about him that he can say stuff like that and it doesn't come across really, really harsh, but you get the message. And I think Pat did that with a lot of people. He could deliver a message with a bit of wit and a bit of sarcasm, but lads knew there was a serious undertone in it. And he also had to respect the guys that like, we worked hard in that group about kind of working on feedback with each other and kind of not taking it personal, and it was all about trying to improve the team. And I think as the years went on, we got better and better than that. And I think that's one of the real strengths, even following on to Jim Gavin's reign, that was one of the real strengths of this Dublin team, is that when something goes wrong or something needs to be said, lads can say it and it's not perceived as an argument or a row. It's perceived as a bit of constructive criticism and kind of lads are maturing enough to take it on the chest and move on. And to be fair, Bernard probably knew that he needed to do a bit of work in his defending as well, as I probably did as well. And that was the challenge that was put to us. And like, when you think of the score we got against Kerry, Stephen's free against Kerry, like, Kerry had possession of the ball in the last few minutes of the All-Ireland final in 2011. And some would say Kerry threw that away. But I firmly believe that turnover we won back in the middle of the field was for Kevin McMenamin's goal, that turnover that we won back, we'd worked on that relentlessly in training, that sort of thing, compressing the field really tight and full forwards coming out to around the half forward line, midfield area to try to win a turnover. So it definitely wasn't something that happened by accident. It was something that we had worked hard on, and we were just lucky enough that it came to fruition at a crucial stage of that game.
You were slow enough to accept, though, that the role of the full forward was also to be a defender. You kind of felt like there should be an ability to stay up front, a bit of goal hanging maybe.
Yeah, and it wasn't even in a really selfish way. It was more about if you're chasing all the way back, as Ryan McMenham did, or what Philly Mack does to teams now, is he goes like the train out full back and brings a full forward all the way down the field, and then when they're trying to come back up, they're knackered. So I was just saying that should we have somebody up there holding their pace or holding their gas so that when the ball comes up that they can take on their man and get a score. And that was I thought that there was merit in that argument, but I understood that obviously everyone rose in and there will be someone there, like you just have to get on with it. But yeah, Pat had, as Alan said there, like he created this red zone where we wanted to work in numbers and to hunt in packs. And now he's saying it there, that turnover at the end was a byproduct of that.
Does he have a Homer Simpson voice? Because there's a bit where I'm like, oh, look at me, I'm Bernard Brogan.
A bit like that, yeah. That's the way it felt, yeah.
It was. He put on a little voice, yeah. And he delivered a message. So, funny enough, I remember the meeting very well. And I was kind of about to agree with Bernard and say, yeah, maybe we could leave somebody up there. It didn't always have to be Bernard, but it'd be good to have somebody up there if we want to turn over. And yeah. Thank God I didn't
voice it, yeah.
Because it was a complete and utter setup by Pat to lure Bernard into that. To kind of say that, yeah, I'll stay up here and let the lads do the work and then I'll be fresh when it comes up. So he really did. He was like a fish on a hook learning, man. I think everyone could see it, as Bernard says in the book. And he was in too deep before he could...
I saw it coming then at the end and I was like, oh, I can't back out. I have to back the point. But I knew he was he's ready to cut me in half.
So is this after the start of the Airways game or is this even later?
This was after it, yeah.
Before the 2010 season, because 2010 you're not getting in the team at the start of the year and end up footballer of the year.
So. Yeah, it was in around that period, probably after the National League, where I was probably turning a corner. But as Alan said, it wasn't just me. He was asking hard questions of. He understood psychology well. He went away into the course in psychology that I think in 2009 about just understanding people's mindsets. And he put a lot of pressure on Alan for different things. Barry Cowell, a lot of senior players got asked a lot of hard questions by Pat, not just me. Mine was probably the heaviest, but he probably sensed that I got energy from it. Like I love when he called me out, and I give an example of he's a great leader. By then, at one stage, one of those meetings that he called me out, he actually rang me before it and said, I said this before, but, and he said, Bernard, I'm just letting you know, I'm giving you a heads up, I'm going to cut you in half in this meeting. I just feel the group needs to have a, and I think you're whatever you did at the weekend, I think I'm going to use that, but just want to give you a heads up. And I was like, God, this is great. Like, I'm on the inside circle here. So his leadership was that I was empowered. He went into the group, he cut me in half, and the rest of the team were like, God, we have to be selfless and do all this stuff, and I'm there to take the battering ram. But that was the sense of how leadership was, that he understood how to use.
That's after you've obviously responded well to the earlier stuff, because at the start, did you know he was on? I mean, obviously you knew he was on your side, but you must have been a little bit concerned that the new manager has come in and it's like, oh, I don't think you understand my philosophy. You're going to have to work much harder. You're going to have to work from the front, and you're not my team at the moment.
Yeah, and I believe that I could change that. Do you know what I mean? Like I was playing pretty well. I was getting scores. I was doing that bit. So that was my argument back. It's like, I'm scoring five or six points from play here. What's the problem? Is that not enough? And he's like, no, it's not enough. Like, we want to get over the line. We need to work hard as a team to win the big games. And I kind of, yeah, and he just pushed me hard for that. So I felt I had enough quality. I just felt I had to work on some things. So it was kind of that energetic motivation that I was going to get after and be fitter and be better. And when I actually did work harder for the team, I actually ended up getting more chances. The ball was coming back to me as much. I'd pop the ball off someone, I'd go around the loop, I'd make another run, and I'd end up with the ball back and clip it over the bar. So it actually made me become a better footballer. Albeit I was working hard for a team, but I also got more scores and I got into plays much better as well.
Yeah, and it's the old adage, the harder you practice, the luckier you get. Seriously though, Alan, when you were in the car telling them, don't worry, it's not just you, it's grand, did you think that, or were you actually thinking, geez, Pat's going a bit hard on him?
I knew that it was never personal with Pat, and at that stage he'd built up a trust with the players that as I said, we were willing to take criticism and we knew it wasn't personal. And I think, to be fair to Bernard, it wasn't that Bernard didn't track back or didn't work hard or stuff. I think Pat just saw an opportunity to kind of use Bernard as a medium to deliver the message. And what better fella to deal with than like your marquee forward? And he felt if he could get Bernard leading the charge on this sort of stuff, then the message would just filter down to everyone else anyway, and he'd have his job done, you know. So in a way, I think he was using Bernard just to get the message across rather than sometimes really, really having a go at Bernard. Yeah, he wanted Bernard to work harder, but I think if he had Bernard leading the charge and this sort of stuff, then the message would just filter down to the rest of the team automatically, which it did. And like, I don't think Bernard might have got upset at times, but I don't think he ever really took it as personal criticism. And as Bernard said there, Pat would often, kind of line up a meeting beforehand with the message he knew he was going to deliver. He might have a chat with the guys he was going to use in the meeting. He did that with me a couple of times as well. And that was just the way his way of managing. And he had the trust of the players, certainly the senior players, that was okay to do that.
And it obviously worked. Mark O'Shea, the first thing he said was that, you know, he couldn't bring the ball out easily. He talked about getting caught by you in the championship. There's a line in the book from Mickey Hart. Well, that was different after you guys go up and play them in Tyrone. Mm. So you could see the benefit of this coming through. Is that where the confidence comes from in 2011 when the game looks lost? When, under normal circumstances, this Dublin team for the last decade has lost all those games in the pinch where you're a few points down, a few minutes to go, you put in a good performance. Do you know what? Everybody's going to pat you on the back and say, oh, you're nearly there, you're getting there.
Yeah, I think that was the exact thing that Pat was trying to change, was that last 5 minutes in the game, that when it's in the balance, whether you're a point up or you're a point down, do you have the belief to just finish out those few minutes? And he started that, he didn't call it the process, but he started that mindset around finishing out to the end. Mickey Whelan, I can hear in the voice in my head ringing, Mickey Whelan, come on fellas, finish it out, keep going. His training was like, could be an hour and a half, could be 2 hours, it was like longer, keep going, never stop. And that was where that came from. It's just to keep going till the end, and if we keep doing that on a regular basis, we will come out with the results. I know Alan, even I came in 2007, Alan was a big player in the years that a lot of those games went against us, that they could have won, you know what I mean? And that was a mindset thing, I think. It's definitely a mindset. When you're in the hat so many times and you come out the wrong side, that's down to mindset.
Mickey Whelan's like the mad scientist in Back to the Future, where you don't know how long the training sessions are going to be. And for somebody who's so invested in sports science, Alan, it seems weird listening to the whole kind of two training sessions a day, but that was actually breaking everybody down to build them back up. There was a method to that madness.
Yeah, there was. And I think as well as that, like, there's obviously a lot of talk with the two sessions a day, but it was only in a couple of blocks during the season that we actually did that when we were working really, really hard in our fitness. And I suppose Mickey's philosophy was that instead of having, you know, 4 or 5 days a week, why don't we do two sessions on a Tuesday, two sessions on a Thursday, and then you have a rest day in between. And yeah, look, it was tough, but I think, like, the guys were involved in the time really kind of really enjoyed it. It was hard getting out of bed at 5:30, but there's lots of teams doing it now, training early in the morning. Lots of people go training early in the morning, so it was that kind of set the tone for when that started to leak out. But I know the guys were involved and certainly enjoyed it, and it just gave you that bit of belief that you have the work done. And once you have the work done, the training in the tank, then it's easier to go out and deliver a performance on a match day. But yeah, Mickey Whelan was like that. He was obviously very knowledgeable about the whole sports science, about the rest, recovery and stuff, and that became a huge part of what we were doing as well. But there was the occasion where Mickey just decided that as Bernard says, we just keep going here, and it was to really test the lads, test the mettle of the lads, obviously work on that extra bit of fitness. But I think the guys that were involved in that team relished it at the time.
Because people are disappearing from training sessions and never being seen again. Like, it's kind of, it is very Darwinian in some ways, and that's the birth of the success.
Money in the bank is what Mickey Whelan used to say. Money in the bank, fellas, money in the bank. You cash it in over the summer. That's basically what he's trying to do. He's trying to give you a mindset that you've done the hard work, that when you were in a sunny day in Croke Park with 70 minutes gone, you'd think back to that morning. You did it for an hour and a half in the snow out in Clontarf for wherever it was. And I remember some sled sessions. They're well documented, but some out in Nelfy Byrne there out in Clontarf in Fairview, in the snow, and seeing lads who had to bulk up. So there's certain lads were doing different things, and some of the lads doing the sleds inside the pitch, and you see them puking at 5:30 in the morning after pushing sleds 180 kgs on it up and down the park for an hour straight, like. And it was, as you say, draconian stuff. But
and much different from what you would have been doing under Pillar.
Like, Pillar really, and I'm not sure if it comes across in the book, but Pillar, and Alan will probably even resonate this even better, he really started that culture piece. He went, that word culture really came into my head through the Pillar days, and he was, as I said, maybe one or two ingredients or nuggets off having that team been really successful, but he really founded that camaraderie, that living, the legacy piece, the culture piece, even the preparation to having coaching in each line, have forwards, defensive coach, midfield coach, our nutrition, our diet. We had strength. We had a strength and conditioning coach. Like, he genuinely brought us on to a level, a new level that Dublin hadn't been in. And Alan was obviously there with Tommy, who was another great manager as well. But for me, just Pat just brought it to that foundation that Pillar had. He had a great culture, a great group of lads. Just needed to be pushed harder, maybe, and just maybe pushed on another gear.
And the belief, Alan, comes from the shared trauma of that training and then the progress that you can see everybody making at the same time.
Yeah, and I think, like, to be fair to Pillar, as Brian said, like, he played a huge role in all of this as well. And if you think of some of the players, like, we were obviously really, really close with Pillar, Alan, but we were probably lacking a few players. Like Bernard came into his prime 2009-2010 with Dermot Condy, with Kevin McManaman. So we probably had a better side coming into Pat's, better players coming into Pat's reign than we had under Pillar. But like as Brian said, Pillar's attention to detail and the preparation stuff was fantastic. Like, I used to get my jersey, it used to be too big for me, and he'd arranged to have the jersey stitched Friday or Saturday before the championship games. Yeah. Stitch the seams of the inside of the jersey so the jersey would be a bit tighter on me, that sort of stuff. So there was absolutely no stone left unturned under Pillar as well. I just think Pat, there was a great base there. Pat and Mickey came in and just added an extra couple of layers onto it and had three or four extra players than what Pillar had, and that's probably what got her across the line.
And that's why I'm telling my story in this book, that I had a bit of comfort, because you can't replicate, like, though, as Alan said there, the building of foundations that Pillar did, the path, the personal challenge
you're
put on players.
You're not giving anything away. Here's the magic bullet. You can take that. Everybody's got
the magic bullet is 15 yeah. years of hard graft. And
the failures stitched in.
Failures, the learning from it. Yes, you need players, like as Alan said, they're coming in and you need that marrying of really good players at the single time, but there's no silver bullet to Dublin success. It is attitude, it's preparation, but it's cultural foundation layers layered over many, many years of managers before them, you know.
I think the obsession with psychology that Pat Gilroy brings in, like, there had been some in under Paul Caffrey, but it goes to a new level under Pat Gilroy, and it goes to another level again when the players themselves are starting to lead the sports psychology, and you've got Kevin McManaman leading meetings. What difference did that make to you? Like, were you somebody who bought into that straight away, that actually there's an edge here that I can get and I'm going to take it?
Yeah, I bought into the mindset piece. I bought into anything that the manager said all the way back to, like, I was just trying to be better, I was trying to learn. I always gave it a try. I say in the book about Pillar's time of our mindset piece, where we had to ring each other and trying to get the collaboration piece, and I had to ring Kieran Whelan and chat about how training was the week before. Like, I was in there a wet week, and Whelan was like the pillar, the mountain of a man that had been driving the team, you know. So what was I going to add to him? But that was, Pillar was trying these things, and as you said, throughout the years it got to an amazing place, and Gary Keegan finishing off and still doing a bit with the lads, I'm sure. But everyone takes something different from it, you know what I mean? Like the older lads might take something different from the younger lads. Kevin McMinnum's a guy who went away and studied it. He now works in that space of mindset. He works with the amateur, the the boxers,
yeah,
that are looking to win Olympic gold medals. So he's lived it, he's loved it, and he's went and studied it. Now he works in space. What a story, you know what I mean? And that's what I love when he talked. And any of the, as you say, the player stuff, the Kevin Mack, that you know it's from the heart when he chats about it. And Michael Darmacaulay as well, who works at it, does yoga, saw him on TV with the toughest show there, doing yoga for lungs.
By the way, wearing those yoga pants, I can't believe he got away with it.
There, you think yoga pants? He wears them on a regular basis. He's an eclectic guy. But yeah, like I think the mindset piece, and I remember even back in the day when Pillar's time, you'd hear some of the older guys saying, it's not for me, just I'm too old, I'm too far gone, and stuff like that. And so you have to, in the group, and you have to have a manager that will allow that kind of difference of opinion to that people can come into it and take a lot from it, or people can just take a bit from it. So it's a balance.
Yeah, and Alan, the other thing I suppose about the Mickey Whelan and Pat Kilroy was that actually they decided that the style of play was going to change and become more defensive, and that puts a greater onus on the attacking players to be able to carry the burden of scoring. And I don't know what that was actually like for you as a forward to live through.
Yeah, I suppose never really kind of thought of it like that at the time. Like I knew after 2008 and 2009, and that wasn't Pat's philosophy necessarily at the start. Like he kind of evolved into that as well, but based on what we needed in the team. And look, I kind of recognised that as well. So I was obviously happy enough for us to say, right, let's get our house in order at the back first, and then we'll worry about what's going on up front after that. But I think that he kind of worked on the defensive strategy first, but it was the whole team. It wasn't just the six defenders in the midfielder. It was the forwards were at the tackle more as well. And every game we went out and played, we had a target for our tackle count. For every quarter, there was a target for the tackle count. And we didn't hit the tackle, that was the only thing Pat cared about for a year, was where we were in our tackle count. And like he always said, until we got that right, until we got that at a consistent level and above 100 tackles, then we weren't going to win in All-Ireland. So that's what we were aiming for every game, was 100 tackles. And more often than not, in the games where we reached that or came close to it, they were matches we won. And games where we didn't come near it, they were matches we lost over the course of his reign.
You talk about the legacy of Gilroy. It's a commercial legacy in terms of actually revolutionising and understanding exactly what the power of the Dublin brand was and getting those sponsors involved and putting the facilities and in place in the back room as well. The football legacy was that team was ready to go, and when Jim Gavin comes in, the mechanics of what the team becomes in the five in a row are already there. Is that fair? Is that like Jim is inheriting a very good situation here where, like, what's the difference between these two? How would you characterise the difference between the two teams?
Yeah, Pat did a lot of work and a lot of building on it, and obviously got us over the line in 2011. And probably, yeah, he probably could have stayed on if he had the ambition. He's obviously very, very big businessman as well, and he had a lot of stuff going on in his personal life that he had to. The manager of a Dublin team has to commit a lot of hours to things, and as the years go on, it's even more. So yeah, Jim inherited a great, great bunch of lads. He says in my last meeting with Jim, he said he wanted to thank me for the group, not just me, but the group welcomed him in as a manager. It's well documented in when Mickey Whelan came into the team in 96, the Dublin team, and I'm sure loads of dressing rooms around the country, when a team is successful and a new manager comes in, there's certain things that were done, certain styles of play, certain ways of doing things that the senior players believe in, that a manager mightn't, and there can be conflict. But in fairness to Pat, the way he'd set us up and the way he'd built the team, we were a very respectful team. We were hungry to learn. We were hungry for success. And Jim benefited from that, and we benefited, I suppose, from it. But having that mindset that we were just willing to get after things, we hadn't fulfilled their potential. We felt like there was more in the tank. And Jim hit the ground running, and I'd say it definitely helped that momentum. Obviously, 2013 we got over the line, 14 we had a blip, and that set us on the road. But I definitely think every manager had a massive part to play in the legacy of this. And Pat really, for me, because he kind of, I worked so closely with him, and he put so much pressure on me and got me to be the best I could be. I'd feel he had a big role in it.
What was your favourite All-Ireland?
It's a hard one. 2011 would probably be very difficult to top the crack, and just getting over the line of 16 years, like Alan had been playing for I don't know how long, there's 9 years, 10 years playing, and I'd been around there since 2005. It'd been nearly a relief getting over the line, and we had great crack. We partied hard and really enjoyed it. Nothing ever beats your first time, you know what they say.
Yeah. Well, what about you, Alan?
Yeah, definitely 2011. Sure, hardly played in any of the other ones that we won. Yeah, but 2011, for obvious reasons, the first All-Ireland, and then 2015, obviously finishing off the way it did, that will always be special too. But I think, as Bernard says, it's very hard. And considering what had gone into 2011, like the 10 years previous for me, the lads I played with, like Tlucko, Barry Cahan, Mossy Quinn, Paul Casey, these lads who had been there since the start, and to finally get her across the line when it looked for so long that we wouldn't. As Bernard says, probably a huge sense of relief initially that just we finally managed to get one. But then obviously after that was a fantastic few months after that, and we probably paid a bit of a price for it in 2012. But that's history now. But I think for me it was always going to be hard to replicate the feeling in 2011. So I'd have to go with that one.
Yeah, it's almost inevitable at some point that, you know, the first time after a famine, things are going to go a little bit haywire. But listen, it's been great chatting with you, Bernard. The book is brilliant, and I hope it's going to be a massive success. It's called The Hill. It's available now in all good bookshops. Continued success with it. And thanks to both the Brogans for talking to us there.
Thanks, Ben. Cheers.
Thanks, Jared.
OTB AM.
With Gillette, we don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters. That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.